Well, our next guest is a lot more than a tomato farmer, although he began his career growing tomatoes in southern New Jersey with his younger brother. Then he got a degree in agricultural science from Rutgers. Then he spent 6 months living in rural India, where he became very familiar with population issues and food issues. In 1959, he joined the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Foreign Agricultural Service as an international analyst. He's got master's degrees. He's got all types of degrees from Harvard and University of Maryland. The Washington Post calls him one of the world's most influential thinkers. The Telegraph of Calcutta refers to him as the guru of the environmental movement. 1986, the Library of Congress actually requested his personal papers, noting that his writings have, quote, already strongly affected the thinking about problems of world population and resources. And in 2012, he was inducted into the Earth Hall of Fame in Kyoto. And so I'm not sure why Lester Brown would join us, but I sure am excited to have him back. Welcome back to the conversation here on Earth Day, sir.
Thanks, Pete. Glad to be here.
I know you and I both agree that Earth Day is every day and try to live our lives as such. I've tried to learn a lot from your life. You've wrote a book about it, or your most recent book, Breaking New Ground, A Personal History, I should mention in your intro. You've written or co-authored 51 books. How are we doing this Earth Day 2014? You've been following this issue of sustainability and population and food. Where are we, sir?
Well, it's late in the fourth quarter, and we're trailing by at least a couple of touchdowns, I think. It's scramble time. We don't have a lot of time to cut carbon emissions, for example, and try and stabilize the Earth's climate before it spirals completely out of control. The good news is that we're beginning to see some exciting advances in the development of wind and solar energy. In China, for example, to cite a huge advance there, they're now planning 6 wind mega complexes, each of which will have at least 20,000 megawatts of generating capacity. That is, each of these will be equal to 20 nuclear power plants. The largest of these 6 will be in Inner Mongolia, where they have really strong wind. There, they're planning to develop 38,000 megawatts of generating capacity. To put that in perspective, that's enough electricity to run a country like Poland. So we're seeing a scaling up of renewable energy now, in this case wind, on a scale we've never seen before. We are also seeing some dramatic advances in rooftop solar photovoltaic arrays. And this is leading to a situation unlike any we've seen before, because as the homes in the community, as more and more residents put these rooftop solar cells to supply their electricity, the market for the utility begins to shrink. And as it shrinks, the utility then has to raise prices in order to keep going. And as the more it raises prices, the more economic it is to put rooftop installations in. And so this is becoming sort of a death spiral for utilities. And it's taking us in areas we've never been before. I mean, who would have imagined a few years ago that the existence of utilities would be threatened by solar energy?
Well, we're seeing laws now being passed in Oklahoma because they are taking solar seriously. And so, in a way, it's a good thing because they're finally paying attention. And obviously, we have to fight against, I think, these laws, at least the way I understand them. We're talking to Lester Brown. He's on Twitter, by the way, at Earth Policy. You mentioned new sources of energy, wind and solar, and their development specifically in China. What about new sources of carbon capture? Could that help us late in the fourth quarter down by 2 touchdowns? Right now, we're killing some of our sources of carbon capture with deforestation, if I'm not mistaken. But is there technology that we could use to capture carbon? I've heard about it, I've read about it, and I've dreamt about it. What do you think of that? Is that something you've paid attention to?
I have. And I think it's a dead end because the cost is too high. If we're going to invest, let's invest in something we know is going to work and we've had some experience with, like wind farms and rooftop solar installations. The good news now is that rooftop solar energy is solar electricity is getting so cheap that even big firms like Walmart, for example, are beginning to install them on a large scale on their rooftops. There's a whole long list of major companies in the United States that are looking at rooftop solar installations again on a scale we've never seen before.
I was just in Indianapolis and just outside the airport, and when you're leaving the airport, they have a huge solar farm, although I didn't see many on the homes, any actually in Indiana. So I was curious as to what their policies might be. But not only are some private industries using this, but certainly different cities and states and the federal government has done a lot to incentivize it, because it's really, really working, right?
No question. Another example, Iowa and South Dakota each now get about 25% of their electricity from wind. Iowa plans in the next 4 years to take this up to 50% and beyond. Iowa will be the first state to get over half of its energy from the new sources of energy, from wind and solar and so forth. And then we saw Warren Buffett dump a $1 billion worth of wind turbines that he bought from Siemens in Europe in Iowa to enable them to harness even more wind energy. So we're seeing things happen now on a scale that we've not seen before. A billionaire from Denver, Phil Anschutz, is building a huge wind farm in California that will have somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 megawatts of generating capacity. And he has an old railroad right away that goes to California, and that's where he's going to build the transmission line. He's going to sell Wyoming wind energy to California on a huge scale.
I'd like to talk with you, Lester Brown, a little bit about your work with, obviously, sustainability and population issues. You spent a lot of time in India. You mentioned China. These developing countries, their populations are exploding. What are some of the challenges that these developing countries have with feeding their populations, with providing them with energy? Talk to me about those issues, because I really have not done a lot of work and certainly haven't done many segments here on the radio show on these issues that you spent so much time of your career working on and writing about.
Well, there are still some countries, in particularly in the Middle East and in Africa, where population growth rates are running about 3% a year. 3% a year means a 20-fold increase in a century when you compound it and work it out. And that's just not a viable option. There are other countries. Japan, for example, has a shrinking population. Russia has a shrinking population. So do many of the countries of Europe. Germany's population is shrinking slightly. So we've got a good part of the world now that has largely stabilized its population, but we still have a substantial chunk, the Middle East and Africa, that have not. And that's where and India is still lagging behind in getting the brakes on its population growth. So the big challenges on the population front are India and Africa.
And what are they? I mean, what are those? I mean,
well, it's a combination of things. There are a lot of women in these countries that want to plan their families. They want reproductive health care, but they're not getting it. And the cost of providing that is so small relative to the benefits to those societies and the world as a whole, make it inexcusable that we're not doing something about it. I mean, making sure that every woman in the world who wants access to family planning services and does not now have access would cost us so little, it would get lost in the rounding of our defense budget.
And yet
it is one of the more important threats to our future security.
How is it a threat to our future security?
Well, because we're all competing for the same resources in the world, the water, the food, the energy, and so forth. And if the population keeps growing at 80 million a year, which is what it's been doing for the last few decades, at some point there won't be enough water to go around, for example. And in fact, water is emerging as one of the principal constraints on on population growth.
We're talking now to Lester Brown, who is a legend in the environmental movement, a guru in the movement. It's such an honor to have you joining the conversation, and I so look forward to meeting you and sitting down with you at some point when I'm down there in Washington, D.C. When you – so often people will say about climate change, the environmental issues and so on, well, I'm just one person. I'm just one person. And I think because of – they believe that for whatever reasons, they don't think that they can make a difference. In your career, in your time – studying and writing and talking about these issues, what is the value of one person? What can they do? Is it simply going out and voting for the right policymakers, or is it something that we do in our own private lives in terms of our consumption and our own efforts to create sustainability?
It is both of those, and also becoming politically active. We've seen enormous changes in over the last several decades in where people have taken action to change things. Cigarette smoking would be an example. I mean, I can remember when there were no bans on cigarette smoking on planes. And then they decided to push the smokers to the back of the plane. And then eventually smoking was banned altogether on planes. Now, that took some time, but there were a lot of people who were beginning to think, you know, I have a right to clean air when I'm flying. I shouldn't have to breathe smoke-laden air. And it changed things. And sometimes these changes come very quickly and unexpectedly. And a prime example of that would have been the Berlin Wall coming down. Remember, East Germany was totally isolated and separated from West Germany. And then suddenly things began to change, and the leadership in East Germany realized that it was over, and the wall literally came down, and people started leaving East Germany for the West. So I mention those things because those are things that have happened in our lifetimes that represent major social or political changes.
When we talk about what we can all do, and you talk about that shift, I feel like demonstrating to my kids these choices is a very important thing. From the perspective of a parent, how much of a difference does it make when you just role model this behavior? Because I feel like that's one of the big answers for the next generation. Like, you know, I always mention simple things that I think people don't realize. But for example, not taking a plastic bag from a merchant, especially for one item.
Right.
And when, you know, I plug my car in, not because it's better than it would have been for my carbon footprint to keep my old car. It would have been better for me to keep my old car just as to not create a new car. But so my kids see it. I'm getting solar panels. So my kids see it. Is that effective? I'm not asking for a pat on the back. I'm asking, does it really make a difference?
It does. And it also sometimes goes the other way when we're moving into a new era of change. It's the kids learning it at school and coming home at the dinner table and say, Pop, Mom, you know, how come we're doing it this way? We ought to be doing this, you know?
Sure.
And that changes things. I mean, I've heard business executives, major corporations say, you know, we decided to change our corporate policy when my 15-year-old came home and said, hey, Dad, you know, how come you guys are doing it this way? And that's how change comes about, and it can start with one person. It can start with one 15-year-old kid.
You know, I wonder here as we wrap up our conversation, Lester Brown, you know, you're one of my heroes in this movement. I learned so much from talking to you and more from reading you because I only had a couple conversations with you. But who are your heroes? Who would you pay it forward to in terms of giving out names and so on to the people that inspired you? Because one of my mentors in the environmental movement who works at the Fisheries and Wildlife Agency, his name is Steve Chase, and he conducts their continuing education for them. And he's sent me so many books, Lester, from, you know, Rachel Carson to the great environmental writers and so on. Who inspires you that still is relevant to today that I think young people should and could be reading and learning about?
Right. Rachel Carson was obviously an extraordinary person in terms of influencing social change in the environmental area. Another would be E.O. Wilson at Harvard. You know, his specialty is ants, but he writes about the environmental system and helps us understand the interactions within the system and why it's important. If we want to save the diversity of life on Earth, why we've got to change. Another example would be Ted Turner. Ted has, just a side example, he has a ranch in Montana that's about 200 square miles. He's taken all the fences out of that, all the vestiges of civilization, cleared it, let it go back to the way it was 10,000 years ago, and the bison roam up and down that that valley, that 200 square miles, and he doesn't touch them at all. I mean, it's theirs. There are a couple of wolf packs on his ranch. Now, a lot of ranchers would try to get rid of the wolves. Ted welcomes them. They're spinoffs from the Yellowstone pack that have ended up on his ranch. So he would be an example of the kind of person I would I'd look up to.
Well, I continue to learn from you and your work, and I'd like to welcome you anytime you want to come on the program to teach us and take calls and so on. We really appreciate you joining us here on Earth Day. Leaving on a positive note, you have a lot of hope for the future, or are you more pessimistic?
I do, and the reason I do is because I know change can come very quickly sometimes. I mean, I think of the mobilization for World War II, where we weren't producing any weapons to speak of, and then suddenly President Roosevelt forced the automobile company, he banned the sale of cars, forcing all the automobile companies to start making tanks and planes and things. It was a remarkable thing, but we just simply took off from there and eventually, of course, won the war. But it's that kind of leadership that can make a huge difference.
I'm thinking of giving up on my tomatoes. Why is it so hard for me? Shouldn't it be easy? I mean, you grew whole farms. You were like the biggest tomato grower in New Jersey at one point, I read. I mean, there's so many different breeds and there's a lot of different variables, but it can't be that hard to grow a few plants. And yet mine never seem to really I don't really seem to do it right, Lester. Mm-hmm.
Get some organic materials, grass clippings or something, and dig down deep. Don't go down just 6 inches. Go down a foot or a foot and a half and mix it in. Get a little fertilizer from the garden store, 5-10-10 probably, and mix some of that in, and you'll get a crop of tomatoes.
I really appreciate the advice. Lester Brown, thank you so much for your time.
Okay. Take care, right. Pete.
There he is. What an honor I have. And I hope you appreciate his time. I know I do. At Earth Policy.